This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakraborty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. The story of Christian Carl Gerhardt's writer is a story of an astonishingly skilled con man. For years, he lived as the aristocratic Clark Rockefeller and convinced many that he came from the storied and wealthy American family.
Then, after a custody hearing in 2008, he abducted his daughter from the streets of Boston and fled. He was arrested 6 days later and was soon charged with the 1985 murder of a man in California. Last summer, after a high-profile trial in that state, Gerhardt's writer was convicted of murder and of chopping up his victim's body and burying it. He was sentenced to life in prison.
The story of how he was able to dupe so many people for so long is the focus of Walter Kern's new book. And Kern has a fascinating perspective because he was among those whom Gerhardt's writer fooled. For many years, Kern considered himself a friend of Clark Rockefeller's until his true identity was revealed. Walter Kern is a journalist and the author of Thumbsucker and Up in the Air, which were both made into movies. His latest book is called Blood Will Out, the true story of a murder, a mystery, and a masquerade. It's a gripping memoir, a psychological profile of a con man and sociopath, and of the writer he fooled. And Walter Kern, welcome to Radio Boston, and congratulations. This book just had me absolutely glued to your pages for the last couple of days, actually. It's really a
wonderful... I love to hear that.
No, it's
Thank
a wonderful, you. Wonderful study in so many ways. So tell us first how you first came to know Clark Rock, the man who went by the name as Clark Rockefeller.
It's 1998. I'm living out in Montana on a small ranch. Newly married, child on the way, and my wife, who runs the local Humane Society, gets in a dog that is crippled and in a wheelchair, a Gordon Setter. The Humane Society, some patrons of the Humane Society, put the dog up for adoption on the internet and are contacted by a man from New York City, Clark Rockefeller, who says he'd love to have the dog. He can take perfect care of it. And there's only one problem. He can't drive out to get it, and his plane is in China with his wife, his private plane. So anyway, the Humane Society, because I'd gone to Princeton and so they thought spoke the language of the East Coast, put me on the phone with him, and he turned out to be so eccentric that I thought, gosh, I got to meet this guy. And
yeah.
Also the Humane Society thought, as a Rockefeller, he might be in a position to make a big contribution. So I ended up driving the dog, driving and flying it, it ended up to New York City and delivering it to him
now,
by hand.
Before you meet him, I was wondering if you could read a passage. This is on page 7. It's the paragraph that begins, "He still wasn't finished trying to impress me," because it gives us a sense of the way Clark Rockefeller impressed you.
Yes, this is on one of my first phone calls with him from Montana. "He still wasn't finished trying to impress me. As though he thought it would burnish his credentials for the role of the setter's adoptive parent, he told me that he lived next door to Tony Bennett, whom he said he could hear rehearsing through the walls at night. He told me that he had degrees from Harvard and Yale, where he'd studied economics and mathematics. He told me that he could sing the words to any song that I might name to the tune of the theme from Gilligan's Island, and he demonstrated with a Cole Porter lyric. He told me that he'd learned from sources that Prince Charles and the Queen had murdered Diana with the help of a team of crack commandos. And he said that he knew from speaking with a close friend, the Admiral of the Navy's 7th Fleet, that the People's Republic of China and the United States had recently signed a secret treaty allowing the communists to invade Taiwan without opposition at their convenience."
He knew a lot. And what impressed you about the kind of knowledge that he had and the way he sort of dropped these little tidbits of sort of eccentric connections and interesting morsels of acquaintances and information and life experiences that he claimed to have?
More than being impressed, I was intrigued. You know, he seemed like a kooky eccentric, but not unlike ones I'd met, you know, at Oxford. I'd gone to Oxford. I'd hung out with, you know, British aristocrats there, which isn't hard to do, you know, a lot of them. And they were nutty and, you know, sort of singular people. And Clark didn't seem all that different. You know, a lot of rich people in my experience were impressed by conspiracy theories and were always gossiping about famous friends. And sort of just as insecure as average people. And I found him intriguing. You know, I'm a novelist and a journalist, first of all. And so I thought, I've got to meet this guy. Not to do it would be professional malpractice.
So you do, eventually you get to New York with the dog, and yeah. You meet him. And I love this early description, this, you have dinner with him. And he convinced you that he did come from the Rockefeller family without actually saying it directly. Give us a sense of how he did that.
This is how he does it. We're on, I don't know, the umpteenth floor, the 50th floor or something of the MetLife building in Midtown New York City at a place called the Sky Club, doesn't exist anymore. And he's gotten a seat at a table near a window, and we're looking out at Rockefeller Center, looking down, as I remember, at Rockefeller Center. As dinner sort of comes to a close, he says, well, why don't we have some fun? I'm doing his voice. Why don't we have some fun? We'll take a private tour of the family's, place there, meaning Rockefeller Center. And he says, I have the key. I said, the key? He said, the master key. Now, I didn't know what to do with such information. It was 10 at night, and the thought was we were going to somehow go through the sub-basements of Rockefeller Center. It seemed like an invitation that was astonishing, but not one you took up. You took a person up on.
Yeah. At any point in these early sort of meetings as you were getting to know him, did you doubt him? I mean, the guy who claims to have the master key to Rockefeller Center, he knew Princess Di, you know, he's heard it from authorities that the titans of the financial markets have planned the meltdown of 2008. I mean, he said extraordinary things.
It wasn't the meltdown of 2008 that they had planned. It was the meltdown of that ended up happening in, I think, 2007. Well, earlier.
Earlier.
This is 1998 when I'm talking to him.
Gotcha.
And the sort of dot-com bubble burst not long afterward. just because he was, they say that even paranoid people have enemies. Well, even phonies make true predictions every once in a while.
Sure.
Anyway, I went to his apartment the day after we were at the Sky Club, and I saw what I thought were maybe tens of millions of dollars of Rothko's and de Kooning's abstract expressionist masterpieces hanging on the walls of his apartment. And as they say, seeing is believing. He was a great exploiter of props.
Yeah. And what did he tell you that he did for a living? He claimed he was a freelance central banker.
Exactly. Didn't know that was a freelance position. He said on our first phone call, I asked him what he did. He said freelance central banker. And I said, well, what does that mean? He said he ran the money supplies and set the interest rates of third world countries. I asked him which ones. He said, well, Thailand at the moment. And I said, well, which others? And he said, that's classified.
Hmm.
No way to check that, really. He described what central bankers do as basically being keepers of dams who let money over a dam, like water, you know, controlling it. And I brought this to an accountant or somebody with an economics degree and said, is that really how a central banker operates? And they said, that is the most succinct description of that job I've ever heard.
Yeah.
You know, so he was always bringing me up short. You know, there's a point in The Great Gatsby where The Great Gatsby says he went to Oxford and somebody challenges him, and then he proves that he did. And Nick, the narrator, says, I was never prouder of him. Well, with Clark, there were always moments where he teetered on the brink of being unbelievable. And then you sort of checked, or he brought out a piece of evidence and you went, wow,
wow.
Must be true.
Wow. Well, so his con game begins to unravel right here in Boston, actually. He abducts his 7-year-old daughter from the streets of Boston. He goes on the run. Suddenly there are questions being asked about his background. Headlines are being made around the world. And his identity is blown. The claim is made that he's not a Rockefeller. He's this Christian Carl Gerhard Strider. What was your reaction when you first heard that news?
It's 2008. It's August. I've known him for 10 years. I've spent about the last year on the phone with him several times, him sort of crying on my shoulder about missing his daughter, who he wasn't seeing because of a divorce. And then I see on the internet, I believe, that he has kidnapped her and there's a nationwide manhunt for him. Then when the Rockefellers proclaim that he's not one of them, I think, you cowards, you know, throwing your own under the bus when there's a hint of scandal. Then when it was sort of proved that he was this German kid who'd basically gotten his accent from the millionaire on Gilligan's Island and, you know, pretended to be a blue blood, I felt this sort of shame and humbling sense of idiocy go through me, you know. How could I be so stupid? Hmm. But when he was thought to be a suspect in a murder and I heard the details of the murder, I knew instantly that not only was he was a fraud, he was a psychopath, and he had killed that person.
Sure. And you spend a lot of time in this book really talking about your frame of mind, you, the narrator, and how you came to believe him. And I'm just wondering, from this whole experience, you know, what did you learn about yourself? What did this do to you as Walter Kern that you were duped for so long?
Well, I'll tell you what. I wrote this book because, you know, out there in America, it's okay to confess that you're an alcoholic. It's okay to confess that you're a drug addict. It's okay to confess all sorts of sort of weaknesses and crimes, but it's still not okay to confess that you're a fool. Well, I was a fool, and I went through forensically and tried to examine all the times this guy had fooled me and why I had been susceptible to it. And I came up with a lot of answers. One, that I'm a trusting person. I grew up in a very small town in the Midwest, and we took people at face value. You know, this is a book about trust and how essential it is in life, but how easily it's abused and how horrible it feels when it is, because coming out of this 10-year, masquerade that was practiced on me, I suddenly didn't trust anyone. Mm-hmm. You know, a plumber would say, leave me a key so I can go look at your sink today. And I'd think, is he really a plumber?
Oh,
you know,
boy.
I'd see cop sirens next to the road and I'd think, is that a cop or somebody who, you know, put a red light on his car? I mean, I'm not really exaggerating. It's mind-bending to suddenly realize that the fabric of reality can be woven by a deceiver completely convincingly.
Yeah. Walter Kern, our time is running down, but there are two more questions that I'm just dying to ask you. First of all, you know, you attended his trial. You write about it in a fascinating way in this book. And the details of the murder that he committed are truly ghastly. And we learn that this is a truly violent sociopathic man. Did you look back at your time with him and say, holy moly, I mean, I was in danger. I mean, this guy could have chopped me up and buried me in the backyard.
You know, as long as I was writing the book, and I finished it just last November after his murder trial because I had to wait to see if he was convicted. Didn't know the ending. As soon as I finished the book, I woke up the very night after I sent it in a sweat from a nightmare in which I'd been driving in a car alone with him on a country road, and he'd asked to pull over saying he thought there was a flat tire, and I realized that he was capable of anything and I was alone with him. You're seeing a guy who has fresh off the dock PTSD. I mean, or you're talking to one right
now.
Wow,
really? And you actually visited Gerhardt's writer in jail, if I'm not mistaken, after he was convicted, right? You went and faced him face to face through the glass and asked him straight out if he committed the murder.
Yes.
What did he tell you?
And he blamed it on the murder victim's missing wife, who it's presumed was also murdered by him. But he said something monstrous that I think a Boston audience might be interested in. This was almost exactly a year ago. The Boston Marathon bombing had just happened. And this is how monstrous this guy is. I asked him if he'd heard about it because he lived in Boston. He said, oh, yes, I heard about the bombing. Well, it's kind of good news for me. Everybody in Boston talks nonstop about me, and now they have another topic.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
That's how horrible this man was. And I'll never forget being in his presence.
One more question. You asked him how he manipulated so many people for so long, and his answer explained a lot about how he did that.
Yeah. I asked him, I said, well, you're not going to admit to the murder, but you were a con man. You were an imposter. How did you do it? What's the secret to manipulating people? And he said, three words, vanity, vanity, vanity.
Mm.
And what he meant by that was he takes what you wish you were and he reflects it back to you as though you really are. And you become addicted to the sensation of being what you fantasize you are. And he knows that that's going to work.
Wow. Well, Walter Kern, it's such a great piece of writing. It's a terrible story, but wonderfully told. Congratulations, and thank you for joining us.
I really appreciate it. Thanks.
That's Walter Kern. He's a journalist, author of the new memoir, Blood Will Out, The True Story of a Murder, a Mystery, and a Masquerade. It tells the story of Carl Gerhardt's writer, a.k.a. Clark Rockefeller. Walter Kern, thanks again.
Well, Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Our show is produced by Amory Sievertson, Dina Rosendorf, Alex Kingsbury, Emma Jean Weinstein, and Kathleen McNerney, with help from Jamie Bologna and Anna Taylor.
Tim Skog is our technical director, and we've been receiving help from Eddie Mazulis.
I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.